All right, we are back, and I am pleased to announce that we have both Dr. Tony Held and Dr. Whitney Lehman from the Department of Environmental Engineering at UCD. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for top billing.
Well, you deserve it.
No, he doesn't. What do you mean?
Now, you guys are both, in some fashion, atmospheric science-related folks, are you not?
We have minors in atmospheric science, actually. Right.
Close enough. All right. On my trip, which I was talking about on last week's show, and I should maybe, if I have time, talk a little bit more about on this show, I witnessed something that I've seen now, I guess, six times that I wanted your comment on. And the tie-in to this, Tony, of course, is this comes directly from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, continuing in the series of books that you've handed to me. This one is Plunges into the Universe, I think the 15th edition. Chapter 14, The Green Flash. You've seen gorgeous sunsets with brilliant reds, oranges, violets, pinks, and yellows, but have you seen the green? The green flash, the split-second burst of green just as the sun dips below the horizon. Lots of people talk about it. Half of them think it's a myth. The other have actually seen it. It's not a myth. I just saw it again in Tobago.
See, it's whether you think that there's actually a physical green light that's coming at you, or whether you're perceiving a green light. I'll go with you may perceive a green light, either that or you're schizophrenic. But it could very well be that it's just if you stare at an orange sun for long enough, as soon as the orange sun goes away, the complementary color appears in your mind. Just like if you stare at a flag that has the reverse colors and then stare at a white piece of paper, you'll see the true colors of the American flag. It's just a perceived event.
I've seen pictures like in Life magazine showing where you can actually see a bit of orange sun and you still see the green flash right on top of it.
And so is the green flash more intense? Is the
It's not really like a flash bulb going off, but it does distinctly go green.
It very well may, but there's also lots of pictures of the Loch Ness Monster. Well, and lots of people who claim that they've spontaneously combusted or seen somebody who did the same.
I know, and Bigfoot pictures too.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not as bad as the Yeti, right? But I haven't
seen... Maybe the same phenomenon that tricks the eye tricks the camera as well. You just...
No, I'm going to dig out I don't have time today, but I will dig out the picture of this because I think it's more convincing. But believe me, I've seen it, and it's always the same kind of deal. I've seen it in San Clemente, I've seen it in Kona, Hawaii, I've seen it in Kuta Beach, Indonesia. Usually you're in a tropical location, and if you have a little height, it seems to help the process. To be like looking over the sea from like some altitude.
It's not a tall people thing.
No, as far as I know. Although I've seen it right on the beach too, so it can't be, you know, it's not necessary to have height. But the article from Dr. Johns gives a theory that, you know, it's believed that as the sun continues to descend and you're getting that prism effect, that the blue light is scattered, which is why the sky is blue. The red sort of gets bent out of the way. And then for that brief instant, it's the green part of that, you know, prismatic bending that registers on the eye, which I think sort of rings true to me.
Well, I'll buy that the sky is blue because of the scattering. I'll
and
go
sunsets
with that.
Are red because red light scatters the least. That's why you see red sunsets.
But you guys aren't buying the green flash.
Well, I haven't seen anything convincing one way or the other.
Holy mackerel.
Well, when do you see the green flash? Is it only over a flat horizon like the ocean?
Well, according to Dr. Johns, you don't require the ocean. You can see it looking at the true horizon, but I think that it helps to see have the ocean working for you, and I've only seen it on the ocean.
Could be one of those complementary color things going on, either that or reflection off the water.
Right
it
could, now,
maybe it does have something to do with reflection. Forget about the complementary colors. If we assume that there is some sort of phenomenon involved, then perhaps it has something to do with reflection rather than just direct scattering through the atmosphere.
I've also seen double late night in bars, which doesn't mean that there's a multidimensional event that happens at 2 a.m.
Okay, I can see right now we're going to have to return to this topic after doing a little more homework. All right, number two, from New Scientist magazine, another article. This one actually blows my mind, and I'd like your guys' comment on this. According to New Scientist, a British journal, they're now able to actually date precisely using carbon-14. They can actually tell, for example, using pollen in, say, a heroin sample, contaminant in a heroin sample, the actual year of the pollen, the year of the heroin, because back in the 50s and 60s, when we did nuclear tests in the atmosphere, these bomb pulses evidently doubled the amount of carbon-14 in the Earth's atmosphere. This is news to me, and I'm quite stunned to hear it.
Well, also, there have been other events that have put a lot of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, I thought, as well. So,
like what?
Chernobyl or something like that.
Oh, I guess so.
I believe so. Yeah, I for sure that did. I'm not sure what other events might have also caused that. But why pollen? Why would there be pollen in heroin?
Well, I think there's pollen or contaminant in just about anything. And this was the idea. If you can find the pollen grains, you can then use this test, which I guess must have fantastic accuracy.
Yeah.
But the article says, you know, normally you can date within tens to hundreds of years. Like, you know, the Shroud of Turin was proven to be, you know, fake by examining pollen and things in the shroud. Or I guess the shroud itself actually was proven to be made about in the 1300s. But this apparently, with this pulse of C14 that's sort of refreshing the pool, as it were, I guess they've got increased accuracy. But just what boggles my mind is that we doubled the amount of carbon-14 in the air.
Well, it's quite a boon for heroin addicts if they prefer a certain year of heroin. You know, they can become snobs and say 73 was so much a better
like
carbon-14.
Dom Perignon.
Yeah, that's right.
This was a very good vintage.
Yeah. Only the discerning heroin addicts need apply.
I guess this came up when they were trying to decide whether opium produced in Afghanistan was old stuff, pre-2000 stockpiles, or whether it was fresher stuff. And I guess now they can tell that.
Carbon-14 and lead, actually, people I think use one of the isotopes of lead, because there was so much lead in gasoline and it got into the environment in the 70s. It's the same sort of thing. You look at time trends using some sort of isotope ratio, and you can base it on events that have happened in the past, like lead and gasoline. And when you took lead out of gasoline, you see less of different types of lead isotopes in the environment. I'm sure it's the same sort of thing.
You would be curious to know is what the error bars are on these measurements.
Yeah.
You know?
Or what method of detection, because carbon-14 detection, depending on whether you use accelerator mass spectrometer or scintillation counting, can be either very precise or very inaccurate.
It was like when I bought an aerial map of Sacramento for an air quality study. It had the scale on the back, like 1 inch equals 50 feet or something to that effect.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, can you give me a plus minus on that so I know how accurate it is? She's like, sure. So she writes something on the back. I take it to my office and I look for the accuracy. And it said 1 inch equals 50 feet plus minus. That was it. Not plus minus a number. So she thought it was helpful just to have plus minus there. You know. So,
well, that was very nice of her.
Yeah,
to assist
I asked
your
for
efforts.
A plus minus and she gave it to me.
How accommodating. All right, story off the web from Science at NASA. Strange clouds. Apparently, the International Space Station has observed large numbers of what are called noctilucent clouds, or night shining clouds, over the southern hemisphere. Now, these are really high in the atmosphere, like 80 to 100 kilometers. So apparently, they're made of cigarette smoke sized particles of ice. And this apparently is a new phenomenon. According to this article, scientists never really noticed these high-altitude clouds that glow at night until the blowing up of Krakatoa in 1883, after which putting a lot of dust in the other upper atmosphere apparently produced these clouds. There's an allegation here that perhaps with global warming, we're seeing more of these clouds. I don't know.
So when you're talking about these upper air clouds, you know, we think of the atmosphere as where we are on the surface of the Earth, which is the troposphere. And there's all sorts of mixing mechanisms, and this is where all the weather happens, storms and stuff.
Right.
But when you start going up the stratosphere, there really aren't that many exchange mechanisms for things to go from these upper air regions down to the Earth. So once something penetrates by way of a volcano where it can just blast right through the temperature inversion
right.
and get up in there, it's pretty hard to get rid of it. So,
which is, I guess, why when Mount Pinatubo blew up in the 90s, we had all those beautiful sunsets for years.
And Mount St. Helens was disappointing because it shot off at an angle and didn't quite throw all the dust into the upper elevation. But it's also pretty hard to get good measurements when you're talking at these elevations. There's all sorts of great satellite information that you can get, but it's not like you're going to have a sampling effort up there. So,
well, there's apparently quite a bit of mystery, I guess, with these clouds, because they're not quite sure how you get into this called the mesosphere when you're that high, 50 to 80 kilometers up, very dry. How you get water vapor up there is puzzling people. And these pictures are quite dramatic of these streamers over. And the weird thing, too, is that they're visible mostly above 40 degrees of latitude. So here, we're at 39.5. It's Sacramento. We're not quite high enough. If you're up in Washington State or Canada, or Finland, these are much more visible.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would push moisture all the way up there. You'd have to have some serious convection to get moisture up that high, and then it would be localized, so...
I don't think we can convect all the way to the mesosphere.
I mean, no, not to the mesosphere. I don't know how moisture would get up that high. Also, too, I guess the thing about particles in the stratosphere is, I think that's one of the theories people have, the albedo effect, meaning particles reflect a lot of sunlight, and so perhaps it's slowing down global warming, natural events and man-made events.
There's a fascinating article, too, about Earth's weather and perhaps repeating weather patterns over the millennia, over millions and millions of years, is that as we orbit the galaxy, they believe that we may get close to the center. We may actually go through the arms of the Milky Way, and as we do, we would get closer to all these stars that are producing radiation, and that like a cloud chamber where radiation causes little tracks of moisture, you might actually have enough radiation to produce more clouds on the Earth and cool the Earth. Very interesting theory. A little far-fetched, it seems, but you never know.
You know, that sounds like a great paper because no one can really dispute your evidence because, I believe that we're moving through the center of the galaxy and, I've got this great photo. Right. You know.
The clouds are caused by the actions of fairies.
Yeah, I like the water fairy.
Leprechauns.
Yeah. The water fairy. You need hydrogen and oxygen, so as long as you have that, I guess you can make water. But otherwise, in the absence of those things, I'm not sure where you would get water vapor. So,
well, here's one that I think is a bit of a stretch. I'm throwing this one out because I just find this to be very interesting. They've been talking about going to Pluto, the last planet, the planet that we have not visited, the only one we've not sent a robot probe out to. Many people would like to go. We should go. I think it would be very interesting to see what's going on. And there was this sort of time constraint. People were saying we've got to get out there before Pluto's atmosphere refreezes. Pluto got to its closest point to the sun in I guess it was about 1985, something like that. For 20 years, it actually was within the orbit of Neptune. But there's this idea that, when it's at, what for Pluto is, hot summer, the idea was that, when it's closest to the sun, then the atmosphere is at its maximum effect and it's going to actually sort of refreeze. Well, they observed Pluto as it was sort of, going, some stars were going behind it. And to their surprise, noticed that the atmosphere seems to be hotter than they thought. And, what I have this sort of duh reaction to that, because if you think about the Earth, what's the hottest month? August.
For us. Yeah. In the northern hemisphere.
Right, well, that's true, right.
You got to get the heat before you get the temperature.
Well, the thing is, the days are still long, and there's a catch-up effect. What's the hottest part of the day? 3 o'clock. The exact moment where, you have the maximum sunlight is not the moment in which you have the maximum amount of heating. It takes, there's still an effect where it's still, what for Pluto is very balmy weather at this point. Although we should go to Pluto, there isn't this big time constraint that we've got to get out there before the atmosphere refreezes. But what cracks me up is why didn't anybody think of this? It's so obvious in retrospect.
Well, and also, why would you want to go to Pluto in the peak season? You'd better get better rates in the off season.
Just like San Francisco in November, Indian summer. The Pacific is heated up all summer, and then it's nice later on. You don't want to go there in the summertime. Yeah.
All right, another story I wanted you guys to comment on because it's of a scientific nature, though it's nothing to do with the atmosphere. Apparently, the guys at Berkeley who were in on the Drake hoax, it's finally been reconstructed what happened.
Could you refresh our memory on the whole Drake hoax?
Apparently, back in the 1930s, there was some people at Berkeley really, contemplating that wouldn't it be great if we could find the brass plate that Sir Francis Drake said he affixed to a tree somewhere we know north of San Francisco Bay. Drake didn't actually sail into the bay because of, I guess, a fog, but Drake's Bay is still named after him. He did come to the area, and the British, would like to have a claim on California.
As a pretext for invasion?
Well, for historical thing, it'd be nice to say that, he was here, Kilroy was here, we've got the proof. Well, these guys decided, these drinking buddies, decided to go out and get a piece of brass and basically carve on it that, sort of Drake was here, in effect, and arranged to have it found. And to their chagrin, the Berkeley authority, the professor that, was longing for such a finding, got his hands on their hoax and proclaimed it as genuine. And then for years, there was a great battle in the scientific community. Is the Drake plate real or is it not? And I guess metallurgy back in the 70s says, no, it's got impurities in it. They didn't make brass that way back in the Elizabethan era. Someone else analyzed the writing and said, well, they didn't really express things that way. But the pro-Drake side never gave up. And only now, I guess, with another a reconstruction of how this went down with all the drinking buddies, have they pretty much established in this article on the Chronicle what happened. which is kind of disappointing in a way, you know? I mean, it's sort of sad when it's like when the guy that admitted he was Bigfoot a few months ago. It's sort of sad.
Somebody admitted they were Bigfoot?
Oh, you weren't in on that story?
No.
Weren't listening to Radio Parallax. No, we revealed the story of the guy who admitted he put the carved footprints on in 1958 and marched around up in Bluff Creek and started what is the legend of Bigfoot.
It didn't start earlier because Sasquatch, kind of, I thought, the Native American.
Well, there were legends here and there, but really the whole thing started in 1958 with large human footprints tromped around a construction site. What turned out was the guy got tired of his construction equipment being vandalized, so he thought, I'll make a big, big legend of this big, huge human. And after which, they stopped vandalizing his construction equipment. But it took on a life of its own, and that was the beginning of the whole Bigfoot legend.
I think it's also the beginning of a lot of religions, too.
Well, it could be, because people believe in Bigfoot. And what's fascinating to me is that the Roger Patterson film that some people think is authentic, well, the guy that made the footprints, he told them where to go to get that film, which really has to cast a lot of doubt on its authenticity.
Mm-hmm. So that's the famous one where the kind of Bigfoot-looking thing looks back over its shoulder?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Go so, right here on this date at this time, and you'll see Bigfoot.
Exactly. Looks a little suspicious in retrospect. But, you know, it is kind of sad when you put these legends to bed. Bigfoot, the Drake Plate, and, you know, I think we should talk about Loch Ness Monster and the Shroud of Turin.
And the Yeti.
Yeah, the Yeti's interesting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, apparently, you know, if you walk across snow and then you wait a while, it melts into what looks like big, huge human footprints.
Right. I don't think they're human. I think they have two toes. I think that's the distinguishing trait of the Yeti footprints.
I'm not an expert on the Yeti, but that's a subject we should return to in perhaps a future show.
That would be great.
All right. Well, I think we've about had it here on time, guys. But let's stick around for segment three and we'll talk about some funner stuff. All right. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. This is Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.